seemed to notice this change, most likely because they were busy preparing my sister Corey to move away to college. In no way was my behavior a cry for attention during this time. Their distraction simply allowed my dieting to go relatively undetected. I knew I would miss Corey when she left. We had a lot of good times together as kids, with only a 2-year age difference. However, we were as different as sisters come, and we definitely had grown apart as we entered our teen years. She was outgoing, carefree, popular, and had a partying side. I was shy, intense, and preferred to be either alone, playing sports, or with one or two close friends. When I entered high school, I felt like I was known primarily as Corey's little sister, which was certainly not a bad thing, but I did look forward to shedding that label. As Corey prepared for college, I heard more than a few comments and warnings about the freshman 15, the pounds college freshmen tend to put on, from her friends and my family. Previously, comments about weight did not interest me, but now I started listening. Corey had always been thin, not as skinny as I was growing up, but her weight was never a concern. She was, and still is, beautiful. And it bothered me to hear others suggest that she suddenly had to start watching her weight. It seemed to justify my emerging impulse to control my weight, too. Beginning that summer, my motivation for working out became less about getting stronger for sports and more about preventing weight gain. So, I upped the aerobic exercise, specifically running, and decreased the weightlifting. My pitching suffered that summer, but my running improved by the day. Even before I started dieting, I'd been the best female cross-country runner in my hometown outside of New Orleans, and I lost weight and trained. My times drastically improved. By the time the cross-country season began at the start of my junior year, I was becoming one of the top female runners in all of Louisiana. Despite all my outward success, I was struggling with what seemed to be a monumental internal problem, my appetite. After I began purposefully dieting, I started feeling ravenous. I started thinking about food more than I ever had in my life. I began to fear my appetite, and although I tried to fend it off with healthy meals and snacks, I worried it would drive me to eat much more than I wanted to. So I didn't give myself much freedom around food, and I avoided places and situations where I knew I would be tempted to eat unhealthy foods. This only made things worse. By the middle of 11th grade, I'd begun slipping every now and then, eating more than I had planned or eating something very sugary or fattening. This made me very anxious about weight gain, so I began running more to compensate. Even after cross-country season ended that year, I continued my rigid and grueling training schedule. I didn't really like running much, but it suddenly seemed worthwhile to train even harder. Running more gave me freedom to indulge once in a while, and I wanted that freedom because my appetite seemed to be increasing exponentially. By the time softball season started in February, I'd lost about 6 more pounds. My uniform from the previous year was sagging, and I had to tighten my belt a notch or two to keep my pants up. My teammates and new coach noticed my weight loss, but they didn't make a big deal of it. I didn't think it was a big deal either. My pitching that year was indeed much worse than it had been the previous year. I knew the weight loss and concentration on running were compromising my game, and softball was my favorite sport, the one I wanted to continue to the college level. But I didn't have the courage to turn back. I also didn't know how to turn back. Normal eating, once so easy for me, had become elusive. During softball season, I decreased my food intake even more. Without as much time to run due to softball practice and games, I remember not wanting to eat more than a couple of sunflower seeds on the bench because I thought they were too fattening. I remember lying about my eating during that time to my parents, my coach, and my boyfriend. When our team went out to eat after a game, I'd tell my coach I was going to eat when I got home. When I got home, I would tell my parents I ate on the road with the team. On weekends, when I went out with my boyfriend, I'd tell him I'd eaten at home. Then, when I got home, I tell my parents I'd eaten with him. The more calories I cut, the more ravenous I felt. Every time I skipped a meal, it fueled my appetite. Food became a priority in my thoughts. I lost the ability to truly focus on the rest of my life, such that school, softball, my friends, my family, my boyfriend began to fade into the background. I was heading toward anorexia, even though I didn't believe my dieting was severe enough to qualify as an eating disorder. I typically had a large portion of fruit for breakfast, a couple pieces of bread, and more fruit for lunch, some crackers after school, a normal portioned and balanced dinner, and a small bowl of cereal before bed. I ate about 1,000 calories a day, even at my all-time low, but with my activity level and fast metabolism, that was like starvation. Chapter 4. Introduction to Therapy. Note. When I write about what I learned in therapy, in this chapter and throughout this book, I am simply repeating what my therapist told me. The things I learned in therapy are not unequivocal truths and are, by and large, very different from what I believe today. The summer after my junior year, my weight was down another 5 pounds. My parents became so concerned that they sent me to my first therapist. I was reluctant to go because I still didn't think my weight was a problem, but the therapist said I met the criteria for anorexia because I had dropped below 85% of my normal body weight and had missed my period for 4 months. She told me anorexia was an illness and not about food and weight. She said my concerns with food and weight were symptoms of more difficult life issues. Treatment, she said, would involve uncovering the reasons why I was dieting, improving my self-esteem and body image, reducing my anxiety, evaluating me for depression and treating it if necessary, working on any family or relationship problems, and improving my social skills. This was all new to me, but the idea that my weaknesses needed to be treated so that I would stop dieting seemed more than a little odd. Yes, it was true that my self-esteem needed work. I never thought I was a good athlete, even though I excelled in several sports. I never thought I was smart, even though I usually made straight A's. And I doubted people liked me, even though I had many friends. Yes, it was true that I had high anxiety. Even before I had begun dieting, I'd let tests, homework, softball games, cross-country meets, and many other things stressed me out. Yes, it was true that my social skills needed work. I was always painfully shy and got nervous in social situations. Those flaws were simply me, and I was willing to live with those flaws. I felt that my dieting was about losing weight, not about my life's problems. But I wasn't ready to stop dieting because I wasn't convinced I could trust myself to eat normally. I left the therapist's office vowing never to go back. Ravenous. I continued to diet during the summer after my junior year. As my senior year began in August 1998, I felt I was losing control. I started slipping much more often, eating foods that were previously off-limits and in larger quantities. To make up for these slips, I increased my running even more. I was well aware that my restrictive eating habits were the cause of my strong appetite, and I decided that maybe it was time to start eating normal meals again. I feared I would completely abandon control, yet I felt that that was already happening, so what did I have to lose? Maybe, I reasoned, eating normal-sized meals and adding some fatty foods in moderation would help some of my cravings subside. I started to eat meals that were more substantial, but it didn't feel right. A regular-sized meal in my stomach felt uncomfortable and wrong. It made me feel fat and want to go running to burn it off. Furthermore, eating normal meals and reintroducing sweets and fats into my diet didn't help my cravings subside. It only made them stronger. A normal-sized meal, even though uncomfortable, still left me wanting much more. Eating a few cookies made me want the entire box. Eating a handful of potato chips left me wanting the entire bag. Eating a bowl of ice cream made me want to polish off the entire carton. I spent most of my senior year alternating between eating normal meals and restricting foods. On days when I ran more than 4 miles, I allowed myself to eat more. On days when I ran less, I ate less. I maintained my low weight for most of the year, bordering on anorexia. My running continued to improve and I enjoyed my success, but I still felt that my heart wasn't in the sport. Nevertheless, after my senior cross-country season, I signed with a Division I university in Mississippi, the same university my sister already attended, to run cross-country and track. Part of me was excited about it, but another part of me was not. I hated the fact that I'd given up my dream of pitching in college, when only a couple years before, that had been the only thing I wanted to do. I hated the fact that my weight and food obsessions were tied up with running, and I dreaded that the obsession would linger in my college years. I wondered if I'd be good enough to compare in college, or if the other girls would be much faster than me or thinner than me and better able to control their appetites. Part of me wanted to break free and no longer participate in a weight control sport, but another part hoped that things would be different in college and that I would be different as well. To prepare for college, I decided to run track at the end of my senior year, something I had never done because track interfered with softball. I still played softball, but a freshman pitcher all but took my position because I was no longer strong enough to be effective on the mound. It was difficult to participate in both sports at the same time, and the physical stress made me start losing weight again. It was during that time that my appetite finally got the better of me. Throughout my dieting and weight loss, when I'd eaten a little too much, it had never been more than about 500 calories. It wasn't until March of my senior year that I binged for the first time. Chapter 5. My First Binge. My first binge was on sweet cereal, one of the foods I'd restricted for a long time and never felt comfortable reintroducing into my diet, because I craved it more than most other foods. Nearly every night, my dad would eat a bowl of cereal, often the sugary kind that I craved. He always sat on the rocking chair on one side of the couch eating his cereal, and I sat on a recliner on the other side watching television, doing homework, or eating some bland cereal or low-calorie food. When I watched him eat the cereal, I always felt emptiness in the pit of my stomach. I wanted nothing more than to have some of it. I feared my cravings. I thought that if I took one bite of sweet cereal, I would eat the whole box. So I didn't have any. That is, until that March morning when I binged for the first time. When I woke up that morning, I immediately began thinking about the cereal in our kitchen cabinet. It was not unusual for food to be the first thought on my mind on any given day. But this day, somehow, it was more compelling. I quickly got ready for school, thinking I could distract myself by just getting out of the house. I walked to the kitchen, trying to convince myself that I would have only an apple. But soon I found myself staring into the pantry at the cereal. I told myself I would just have a little bit. But I think I knew what would happen. My heart raced as I picked up the box, and my hand shook a little as I poured the milk. Before picking up the spoon, I told myself I'd have to run a few extra miles that afternoon to make up for indulging. I tried to eat the first few bites slowly, savoring the taste, but it was so good. I hadn't eaten sweet cereal for at least a year, so I began to chew more quickly, taking less time between bites. As I came to the last few bites in the bowl, I was eating faster than I'd ever eaten before. I poured another bowlful and ate it much more quickly than the first. After the 2 bowlfuls of that cereal, I ate 2 of another, 3 bowlfuls of still another, then 1 more bowlful of the first. While I was eating, I felt as though an intruder had taken over my body. But when I finished the last bowl, my senses returned a little, and I felt the first, agonizing twinge of guilt for what I had done. I put the empty bowl in the sink and walked slowly out of the kitchen to the reclining chair in the den. I felt like I was in a dream. I still couldn't quite believe that I had eaten so much. Aftermath. I reclined the chair, feeling a mixture of pleasure and apprehension. It felt so good to at last be really full, and I felt enormous relief from finally giving in to my cravings. But I also felt uneasy about gaining weight and shame for being so gluttonous. Temporarily, the comforting feeling of fullness outweighed the negative emotions, and I drifted off to sleep, not caring that I'd be late for school and feeling more relaxed than I'd felt in a long time. When I woke up an hour later and drove to school, all the good feelings were gone. I felt guilty, fat, and foolish. The episode seemed to prove once and for all that I could not control myself around sugary or fattening foods. So I resolved never to let it happen again. I decided that I would be even more determined to keep my eating under control, and I vowed never to touch sweet cereal. I thought about my first binge all day in school, unable to concentrate on my classes, my friends, or softball practice. I felt like a failure for ruining all of the work I'd done to lose weight. I skipped lunch that day, even though I was hungry again by lunchtime. After school and softball practice, feeling weak and tired, I ate an apple and some crackers, then ran 6 miles. I felt better about myself after my run, as though I had righted a wrong, but when I sat down to dinner that night, part of me wanted nothing more than to binge again. I didn't understand how when just that morning I had been so full that I could barely move, I could want to stuff myself again. I was obviously not to be trusted around food, I thought. I would have to keep a tight rein on my appetite, or I might binge again. Little did I imagine, at that same time, that binging would consume my life for 6 more years. My binging increased gradually. I binged 1 more time in March, and 3 times in April. During those months, I still managed to maintain my weight because I was running more than ever. In April of my senior year, my 2-mile track time was the best in the state after 2 meets. However, my success came to an abrupt end in the 3rd meet. As I crossed the finish line after my 2-mile race, I felt a sharp pain in my left heel. I tried to ignore it and kept running for the next few days. But even walking became excruciating. The pain got so bad that I had to go to the doctor, and I was diagnosed with a stress fracture. This was to be the first of 5 stress fractures I would suffer in the next 2 years. My doctor said the injury was most likely from running so much at a low weight. He explained that without sufficient fat cells, a girl's body cannot store enough estrogen. Without enough estrogen, the bones weaken and can fracture. My low estrogen levels also explained why I hadn't had a period for 1 year. He prescribed hormone replacement therapy and told me not to run for at least 3 months. I spent the remainder of my senior year on crutches and then on a walking boot. I feared my weight would skyrocket since I couldn't run, so I cut back on my eating and increased other types of exercise. I got permission from my doctor to ride a stationary bike at the gym, so I biked and biked, often for 2 hours or more. I also took up running in a pool with a flotation belt. I still went to softball practices and games and track meets to cheer on my teammates, but when I got home, I immediately drove to the gym or the pool to exercise. The end of high school. Less than 1 month after my stress fracture, my weight was alarmingly low. This was the time when others began truly worrying about me. It seemed that my friends, family, coaches, and teachers could justify my low weight in their minds when it was linked to my decision to being a successful runner. However, when I fractured my foot and then dropped weight rapidly, they began suspecting something more. A few of my teachers approached my mother to express their concerns, but by this time she was already the most concerned of all. She and my dad tried to talk me into returning to therapy, but I wouldn't hear of it, and I was good at reassuring them. I ate normal meals in their presence, so they saw that I was taking in calories. They knew I was driven to maintain a certain level of fitness due to my approaching collegiate athletic career, and they knew I had a high metabolism and had always been thin. Furthermore, I wasn't completely honest with them about the amount and intensity of exercise I was doing. They thought I was moderately riding the exercise bike and lifting some weights at the gym, when in fact I was biking at extreme intensity for long periods of time. I often showered before coming home and hid my sweat-soaked clothes to hide the evidence. None of this was normal, as much as I tried to convince my parents and myself that it was. My increased exercise brought decreased desire to be with my friends and a loss of interest in the remaining weeks of high school, usually the high point of a teenager's life. I did go on my senior class trip to Orlando, but my clearest memories of that time are of being stressed about not being able to exercise and maintaining my diet while traveling. I packed a lot of healthy snacks for the trip and tried to order low-fat meals from the fast food restaurants where we stopped. I have pictures from the trip of me smiling with my friends, but it felt like I wasn't really there. I mostly lived inside my head during that time, calculating calories and looking forward to the next meal and the small indulgences and desserts I allowed myself. As high school came to a close, I withdrew from most of my friends and lost my first love. I graduated, emaciated, and unhappy in May 1999. I spent the summer before college completely devoted to exercise. I increased my aerobic exercise, running in the pool or riding a stationary bike very strenuously, to about 2.5 to 3 hours per day. I bought my own stationary bike, and each day I carried it outside to ride it on the back porch in the hot and humid summer weather. I felt I got a harder workout outside, and I thought I needed to stay acclimated to the heat for when I began running again. Looking back, I feel terrible knowing my mom had to watch me abusing myself through our sliding glass door every day. A few times that summer, she came outside crying, begging me to stop, because I was pouring with sweat and she was worried that my body could not take the strain anymore. I wouldn't stop. It didn't matter how hot or humid it was. I felt I had to keep up my routine. I didn't know why I felt so compelled to exercise and maintain an abnormally low weight. It became an obsession, an exhausting and self-perpetuating habit. I didn't believe I was vain or selfish at the time, but I was. I focused on my body instead of on more important or worthwhile things. Those who were concerned about me approached me so delicately, as if I were fragile and had a problem I couldn't control. I didn't. It was strong and strong-willed. I was stubborn and deceptive. I placed exercise and weight control above most everything else in my life. I wish someone would have called me out on my foolishness, as people often do with teens who are using drugs or abusing alcohol. I don't know if it would have stopped me or not, but I certainly deserved to be reprimanded. I knew I could stop any time I chose, but I was too good at it. I was too good at being super thin, a shallow goal that simply wasn't worth it. Despite all the exercise and outward restraint around food, my only true desires were to rest and to eat. A lot. My infrequent and secretive binges continued, but despite that, I continued to lose weight. Aside from the binges, I maintained a structured and rigid diet, eating the same types of foods, in the same amounts, in the same places every day. It seemed as though whenever I gave myself the slack to eat a little more or eat something different, I overindulged and sometimes binged. But early in July, I was severely underweight, and my parents began trying to force me into therapy. I probably would have finally agreed to it, but in mid-July, I began gaining some of the weight back. Not by choice. Donuts. I worked at a bakery that summer, and until mid-July I didn't eat any of the foods there. To an outsider, it must have looked like I had remarkable control, but it didn't feel like control to me. To me, it was the opposite. I felt so tempted that if I let myself have just one bite of a cookie or a cupcake, I feared I'd devour much of the counter. The manager let the workers take home leftover donuts because we could not resell them the next day, but it was too risky for me to take any. One day, though, I decided to bring a half dozen to my parents. They never even saw them. 2 hours after I got home, I ate all 6 of them. Just as when I'd eaten 8 bowls of cereal, it was such a relief to finally give in and not fight my cravings anymore. All my anxiety about the bakery, my exercise, and my weight temporarily vanished when I ate. But after the last donut, I panicked. I was terrified at what I had done, and I had to find a way to undo it. A promise to myself to work out more tomorrow was not enough this time. My binges were becoming too frequent, and eating 6 donuts was intolerable in my mind. I needed immediate relief, so I went to the bathroom and tried to make myself throw up for the first time. I tried for about 10 minutes, gagging until my eyes watered profusely and I had sharp pains in my stomach. But my first attempt at self-induced vomiting failed, like all my future attempts would, thankfully. I'd heard of bulimia before, and as I was shoving my fingers down my throat, that word came to mind. However, I did not want to consider the possibility that I could be becoming bulimic. That wouldn't happen to me, I vowed. I would get control of my eating, and I'd never binge again. For nearly a week, it seemed I was in control again. On the day after eating all 6 donuts, I worked out for 4 hours and ate only fruit. Then I got back to my regular eating and exercise routine. But 6 days later, and again 5 days after that, I binged. I began to crave not only food, but the act of binge eating. Once I tasted what a binge felt like, how wonderful it felt to have the pressure of dieting lifted for a few brief moments, to give in to all my cravings and just stuff myself, it became even harder to resist. When trying to fight an urge to binge, I'd remind myself how guilty and fat I always felt afterwards. But I remembered the pleasure much more. It was as though part of me knew the consequences, but another part of me didn't care. I steadily put on weight through the rest of July and August as I binged more and more. My parents were glad to see that I was gaining weight, but they were unaware of the terribly unhealthy route that was leading me there, and how I was exhausting myself desperately trying to burn it off. By the time I packed up and left for college at the end of August, I was binge eating about 2x a week. I thought that college would help because I could occupy myself with school, new friends, and, now that my stress fracture was mostly healed, running. But instead, I only binged more as I began college. I didn't have much of a desire to make friends or go out because my daily struggle with food consumed my life. I didn't like running on the cross-country team, mainly because I had to do so much extra exercise to compensate for my binge eating, that I had no energy left to run. Also, many of the girls on the team were concerned about their weight. I didn't like being in an environment where there was so much talk of weight, calories, and diets. During the first several weeks of college, I broke vow after vow to stop binge eating. I also broke my promise to never return to therapy. Chapter 6. Accepting Therapy. I began therapy only 4 weeks after starting college, on the insistence of my new cross-country coach. During a practice in September 1999, as the team was about to begin running, my coach asked me to follow him. He led me to the office of a sports psychologist, telling me uneasily that I was much too thin and needed to get some help for my problem. I didn't feel I could argue with my new coach as I could with my parents. My parents saw that I indeed ate, not enough to support my high activity level, but decent amounts of food nonetheless, and they knew that I was naturally very thin. It seemed I could convince them that being super skinny wasn't such a huge problem for me as it would be for someone else with a lower activity level, slower metabolism, or genetically larger body shape. I couldn't convince my coach of any of this. He probably thought that I rarely ate, a conclusion most people who saw me at the time would understandably draw. I felt like I had no choice but to follow him to the psychologist's office. But it wasn't only that. It occurred to me that maybe he was right. Maybe I did need professional help. I certainly wasn't having any luck stopping binge eating on my own. Maybe therapy is exactly what I need, I thought, as I walked behind my coach. Maybe the therapists I saw when I was 16 were right all along, and I do have a disorder that I can't control. Maybe I am somehow defective, flawed, or diseased. So over a year after I'd walked out of my first therapist's office, I stepped into another one. This time, unlike the first time, I was willing to listen. I was willing to do what it took to stop my binge eating, because I felt out of control. Over the course of a few meetings with a sports psychologist, he diagnosed my condition. Officially, I met the diagnostic criteria for anorexia, binge eating, purging type, which is used when bulimic behavior, binge eating or purging, exists in an underweight person. As I put on more weight from binge eating in the next few months, my diagnosis shifted to bulimia, non-purging type. At the time, non-purging type was the term used to specify a bulimic who uses diet, exercise, and/or other compensatory behaviors, but does not regularly engage in self-induced vomiting, misuse of laxatives, diuretics, or enemas. Based on my symptoms, the psychologist recommended that I see the campus nutritionist and a campus therapist with experience treating eating disorders. I was hesitant, but I made my appointments, and by October 1999, my days of therapy and recovery had officially begun. The theory that eating is not the problem. What I heard in my first appointment with my new therapist, Jim, was very similar to what my first therapist had told me. My eating disorder was not my fault, and it was not about food and weight. I was told that binge eating was only a symptom of deeper problems in my life that I needed to uncover. Problems like low self-esteem, depression, anxiety, and family and social life issues. Jim said I was using food to cope with feelings. He said my eating disorder was an illness that had hidden benefits for me, which explained why I was unable to stop. He said my binge eating was fulfilling some of my emotional needs, and I needed to learn to meet those needs in other non-eating ways. Although I do not believe this explanation today, at the time I felt slightly relieved to hear my eating explained in this manner. It felt good to learn that my binge eating wasn't my fault, but was instead a sign of illness. It felt better to think of myself as a victim of a psychological problem than as simply a gluttonous individual. It felt better to think that my binge eating was a complex disorder rather than a sign of my stupidity and lack of control. Even though all this made me feel less culpable, it still didn't feel right to me. Intrinsically, I knew my eating problems were indeed about food and weight, as I always had. I thought back to how I'd first begun dieting after my tonsillectomy, merely to lose a few pounds. I thought about how this habit had gotten out of control, making me crave food more than anything. I thought about my first binge, eating 8 bowls of cereal before school, which I knew was only a consequence of depriving myself for so long. I hadn't thought my eating problems were complicated then, so why did they seem so complicated now? Despite my doubts, I decided to go forward with the treatment. The first goal of my treatment, directed by my nutritionist, Debbie, was to get on a meal plan to regulate my eating. Even though I was already eating meals and snacks at regular intervals, they weren't substantial enough to sustain all of my exercise. So Debbie created a dietary plan with me to make sure I met my daily caloric needs. She said if I ate filling meals, it should take away some of my desire to binge. I did my best to follow the meal plan, even though I felt the meals were too big. However, that didn't take away my desire to binge eat. Simply adding more calories to my diet and incorporating a variety of foods, including binge foods, didn't solve the problem. If anything, the plentiful meal plan made it worse because I had to keep more food in my dorm room. Now, I allowed myself access to some of my binge foods on a daily basis, which only served as a temptation that I wasn't able to deal with. Maybe eating more food would have helped me years before, by preventing me from ever binge eating in the first place. But now it seemed to be too late. I knew that simple hunger wasn't the problem anymore, because my urges to binge were just as likely to come when I was full. But if hunger no longer drove my binge eating, I didn't know what did. Debbie wasn't at all surprised that the meal plan didn't put a stop to my binging. She told me I was doing this for psychological reasons, not purely physical ones. She said that the wanting to eat after I was physically satisfied was a sign of emotional hunger, and that I needed to work on those emotional issues with my therapist, Jim. I saw Jim twice a week during my first semester at college. We talked about my past and what could have led to the development of my problem, but we also talked extensively about what could be driving my binge eating in the present. During this semester, I also began reading self-help books for binge eaters, bulimics, and numerous materials pertaining to eating disorders. Therapy's answers. One of the first techniques I learned in therapy was journaling for self-analysis. In my journal, I was supposed to self-monitor by exploring my thoughts, feelings, and moods to determine which ones led to binge eating. I looked for patterns in my binging. At what time of day did I binge the most? What thoughts preceded my binge eating episodes? What feelings did I have in the moments before binge eating? What situations and interactions preceded binges? My therapist explained that if I knew my triggers, the feelings, thoughts, or substitutions that led me to binge, I could learn other ways to deal with them. Now each binge became an event to analyze and a problem to solve. After a binge, I tried to figure out the emotional reason why I had binged. I asked myself, did I binge today to soothe an emotional upset? To relieve stress? To avoid a problem? Did I binge to escape a feeling? Was I feeling particularly bad about myself in the moments before the first bite? What happened today that could have driven me to the refrigerator? What need was I trying to fulfill? I often came up with compelling reasons for my binge eating, but I always thought of these reasons after a binge. Before a binge, all I knew was that I desperately wanted to eat. I learned this was normal. My therapist said it would take me a very long time to figure out, in the midst of an urge, why I wanted to binge, and even longer to learn to substitute positive behaviors. Furthermore, I learned it wasn't realistic to expect myself to resist urges to binge. Instead, my therapist said I should try to prevent those urges to binge from surfacing in the first place. Now, that caught my attention because all I really wanted was to be free of my nonsensical and intrusive urges. They seemed to come so automatically, and I couldn't reason with them. No matter how much I tried to fight my desire to binge or to distract myself from it, it wouldn't go away until I finally gave in. My abnormal need to eat massive amounts of food was ruining my life. So, I wanted to believe that working on therapy goals could prevent those urges. My therapist said that all of the information I was gathering through self-monitoring would eventually help me prevent the urges to binge. Even if I couldn't decipher why I had binged until afterward, there was a lesson to be learned from each binge. Once I figured out what thoughts, feelings, emotions, moods, stressors, and situations triggered my urges, I could address each of them, either with Jim or through journaling. I would then need to learn ways to cope with my triggers in my everyday life. The key to preventing urges to binge, as I understood it, was to deal with triggers before they led to the urge to binge, because once the urge arose, it was usually too late. I began to think about and record very specific situations that seemed to occur before binging. For instance, I discovered that being stressed about an upcoming exam often preceded a binge. Therefore, I labeled academic stress as a trigger. I learned ways to avoid academic stress by studying in advance and better organizing my notes. I also learned ways to cope with such stress by doing deep breathing exercises and taking frequent breaks from studying. Feeling lonely, too, often preceded binge eating, so I labeled loneliness as a trigger. I developed a plan to deal with loneliness, which included calling friends, going for walks, going shopping, and writing letters or emails. This effort turned into a monumental task for me. I discovered countless triggers. My urges to binge appeared in so many different situations, and I found them to be associated with so many different feelings and thoughts and stressors that it was difficult to narrow down the true issues. My urges to binge surfaced when I was sad, but sometimes was otherwise happy. My urges arose when I was lonely, but often when I was with friends or family. My urges came up when I was angry, but also frequently when I was calm. My urges appeared when I was stressed, but sometimes when I didn't have much anxiety at all. My urges surfaced when I was hungry, full, or somewhere in between, and when I was feeling fat, thin, or just right. My urges came when I was feeling hopeless or hopeful, cynical or faithful, invisible or important. Even though there were some distinguishable patterns, there was also inconsistency and unpredictability. It didn't really seem possible for me to tackle every potentially triggering thought or feeling, but I certainly tried. I wrote countless journal entries in which I recorded the trigger I was encountering, then detailed a plan of action to deal with the trigger. In theory, all of this made some sense to me, but in the end, it wasn't practical, efficient, or effective in my recovery from bulimia. Although it was certainly worthwhile to deal with negative thoughts and feelings and problems, that usually didn't prevent my urges to binge. Further, it seemed that if I successfully dealt with one triggering thought or feeling, another would be sure to follow. As it turned out, dealing with all the triggers required more vigilance and time than I had while trying to maintain a good grade point average and compete on the cross-country team. Again, my therapist was not overly concerned. I learned it would take patience, practice, and hard work to get in touch with my triggering feelings and cope with them. Moreover, coping with triggers wasn't the only plan of action. There was a bigger picture to consider, my therapist said, considering the deep-rooted causes of my eating disorder. Jim told me that people who are generally fulfilled in their lives, emotionally, physically, mentally, and spiritually, don't seek fulfillment in eating disorders or other addictions. I learned that my eating disorder was symbolic of a lack of fulfillment or unhappiness in one or many aspects of my life. I also learned that my eating disorder signaled a lack of true identity, direction, and self-love. It symbolized hidden pain from the past that needed to be worked through and resolved. In addition, I learned my eating disorder was a symptom of long-standing problems with depression, anxiety, and perfectionism. In sum, I learned that my eating disorder was an outward manifestation of a complex and deep-rooted inner turmoil. That turmoil was the true cause, but the disorder was maintained on a day-to-day basis by triggers. So, in order to recover, I would need to address both. I didn't learn all of this in one day, or even in my first year of therapy, but this is how I came to understand my eating disorder, as the professionals explained it to me. I didn't take all of this as hard fact, and I internally questioned much of what I was told and what I read. In fact, during the first year of college, I held on to the idea that I could indeed snap out of it and start acting responsibly, which is why after each binge, I promised myself that it was the last time. I saved the wrappers of countless last binge foods, only to replace each one a few days later with another food wrapper. Sometime during the beginning of my sophomore year, I stopped saving the last wrappers and resigned myself to the fact that each binge probably wouldn't be my last. Recovery would be a long process. I came to accept the idea that it could take me many years to finally resolve all the root causes of my problem, learn to deal with the daily triggers, and learn to eat normally again. I still made some resolutions to quit, but only on big occasions like my birthday and New Year's Eve. I came to accept what I was learning in therapy. There were no easy answers, no quick fixes. I don't blame any specific therapist or other professional, any specific book or resource, but the consensus seemed to be that my bulimia was complicated and recovery wouldn't be easy. And this idea turned out to be harmful to me. In therapy, I came to believe that I needed to travel a road of self-discovery and self-transformation in order to be fully free from my problem. I came to believe I needed to change many aspects of my personality, find purpose and meaning in my life, find spirituality and emotional fulfillment, learn to love myself, establish my identity, cure my depression, anxiety, and perfectionism, resolve my past, and find happiness, all in order to free myself from bulimia. Therapy didn't suggest that I should be perfect in this journey of self-discovery. However, it was still a large undertaking for me. I was just starting my life as an adult and trying to find my own way in a big and unknown world. Some days I was more motivated toward recovery than others, but day in and day out, throughout college, I worked on my therapy goals, trying to better myself so that my urges to binge would go away. I tried to fix everything that I thought might be giving me those urges. I tried to improve my self-esteem, took antidepressants, practiced assertiveness, learned relaxation techniques, worked on new ways to cope with my emotions, learned to meditate, and sought spirituality. I talked endlessly to my therapist about my family life, relationships, past failures, and pain, but it didn't stop the cycle of binge eating and over-exercising. In fact, my binge eating only increased throughout my 4 years of college. It seemed that no matter how many deep-rooted reasons I found for my bulimia, no matter how well I followed my meal plan, no matter how well I coped with my daily stressors, no matter how much I tried to find peace and fulfillment, the urges to binge kept coming, and I again found myself in front of the refrigerator or on my way to the nearest fast food restaurant. I didn't know at the time, but my therapist didn't have all of the answers. I trusted them, and they certainly wanted what was best for me. But no one knew then what eating disorders were all about, and we still don't know. In a comprehensive book about eating disorders published in 2003, 4 years after I began treatment, experts said that no one understood precisely how or why eating disorders occur. To date, researchers are still uncertain of the underlying causes and nature of eating disorders. The explanations my therapist gave me for my bulimia were based on theories and conjecture, not on fact. Moreover, their suggestion that I needed to resolve the hypothetical root causes to discover wasn't sound either, as there is no scientific proof that resolving underlying psychological problems leads to recovery. Without knowing this, I accepted therapy and put my faith in it. Confusion and lack of progress. As my therapy progressed, I came to feel that I wasn't making any progress toward my true goal, to stop binge eating. Sure, I was discovering many useful things about myself and learning new ways to deal with a variety of problems, but my binging remained. My therapist never suggested that I just stop binge eating abruptly or tried to explain how I could do that. I learned that I would most likely take a few steps forward, then fall backward many times before fully recovering. But my therapist assured me that the work I was doing in therapy would eventually pay off. It never did. My therapist did encourage me to reduce my binge eating episodes. They did encourage me to set small goals, like putting off binge eating for 10 minutes or binging one less time per week. However, this simply wasn't good enough. I wanted to stop for good, but no one could tell me how. I'm not sure what consumed me more during college, my bulimia or my efforts to recover. Both swallowed so much of my time and energy that the rest of my life seemed to shrink. I quit the cross-country and track teams after my sophomore cross-country season because of my bulimia and because I suffered 4 more stress fractures while running for my university. The damage I did to my bones during high school by losing weight probably caused all of the fractures, and the injuries made it nearly impossible for me to run competitively. To this day, I try not to think about what my running career could have been. I remember sitting in my cross-country coach's office crying as I told him I had to quit in order to focus on recovery. To get away from the pressures of a sport that demanded a certain body type and to let my own body and injuries heal. He was disappointed, but supportive. I didn't feel he blamed me for my failure. I felt he blamed the eating disorder because, like my therapist, he believed eating disorders were illnesses that needed professional help to cure. Despite my doubts and better judgment, I, too, began believing my bulimia was an illness, not a lack of willpower. After much therapy, I accepted the idea that I needed to travel the road of self-discovery to completely cure my disease. I traveled that road for a long time, trying desperately to get control of a behavior that I didn't understand. At the end of my senior year, I weighed 50 pounds more than I did when college started, and I was binge eating about 4 times a week. I was consuming about 8,000 calories per binge and exercising 6 to 7 hours the next day to purge. My habit took up much of my life. Despite 4 years of therapy, college ended just as it had begun. I was still eating other people's food in secret, stopping at gas stations and fast food restaurants to get more and more food, using all my spare change in vending machines, exercising for hours on end, trying unsuccessfully to make myself throw up, and gaining weight. I could write endless stories about the friendships I lost, the relationships I never formed, the wasted time, the missed opportunities, the health problems I caused myself, the pain I caused my family, and the food. How good it tasted, and how horrible it made me feel afterward. But I won't. I have given a glimpse of what my life was like as a bulimic, and anything more would be repetitive and tiresome. I don't want to give the impression that my college years were all bad. There were moments, sometimes days, and once over 2 weeks, when I was not caught up in my bulimia. I did make many friends, a few of whom I remain close to. I did date occasionally and fell in love once. I laughed often, I went to bars with my sister and her friends occasionally. I drank every now and then. I enjoyed many of my classes and got good grades. I had a few good cross-country races. I played intramural softball and tennis. I attended football and baseball games, concerts, parties, and church. I had moments when I felt like a normal college student, and those are the moments that I try to remember. I found there is no use lamenting all the time I lost to my bulimia, because I can't get it back. I can only hope that by sharing my experiences, another young woman doesn't waste some of the most promising years of her life. Chapter 7. Topamax to the Rescue. The day after my college graduation in May 2003, I was alone, my stomach painfully full in my apartment. My family had been in town for the ceremony, but had since gone home. I was going to move back home in a week, so I'd given away most of my furniture. All I had left was a computer desk and a folding chair, a blanket and a couple of pillows and my dresser. I was laying on my side on the floor with a pillow under my bloated stomach. This was something I often did when I was really full because this position relieved some of the pressure. I began thinking about my college years. I had graduated with a degree that I didn't really want or know what to do with. I originally went to college planning on majoring in meteorology, but after my freshman year, I changed it based on something I learned in therapy. My first therapist, Jim, and I talked extensively about learning to live life to the fullest. I admired his apparent ability to enjoy the moment and not let work or responsibilities squelch his zest for life. Jim told me several stories about his most fulfilling adventures and encouraged me to try to find fulfillment in ways besides binge eating. I took the wrong message away from these interactions with him. I took away the idea that I needed to live life to the fullest in order not to binge. I thought living life to the fullest meant having fun, enjoying each moment, welcoming adventures, and living easy, free of any major workload. So I asked myself what major and career path I could choose that would allow me to live life to the fullest. Meteorology, I thought, wouldn't allow it because I would have been required to take difficult science and math courses in college. Furthermore, I saw the work of a meteorologist to be interesting, but also complicated and perhaps tedious, so I chose to be adventurous and change my major. I decided since I love music, I could be happy as a publicist for an alternative rock band, and so I chose to major in communication. That would have been a fine career path for someone else, but it didn't fit my strengths or personality. I didn't care. I was determined to find fulfillment so I could stop binge eating, even if that meant risky decisions for my future career. At 18, I didn't understand that fulfillment could run deeper. It didn't have to mean fun or adventure. Instead, fulfillment could mean hard work, diligence, or making a difference. My dad protested my change of major and tried to convince me otherwise, but I didn't listen to reason. Instead of considering his advice, I thought it was an affront to my independence and my desire to recover from bulimia. This was one of the most ridiculous connections I made between my life and my bulimia. I honestly thought promoting a rock band, the most out-of-character job for me, would allow me to stop needing to binge. Eventually, in my junior year of college, I came to my senses and realized that wasn't the career path I truly desired, but I wasn't sure what I wanted to pursue. By this time, I felt so lost in my eating disorder that it was tough to consider my future at all. School had become an afterthought. My daily struggle with food was so pressing, it was tough to keep up with my classes. I briefly considered changing my major again. To what? I didn't know, but I felt it was too late. I would have required an increase in academic stress and extra time in college, which I didn't think could be conducive to stopping bulimia. For a long time, I had felt the college was getting in the way of recovery. I looked forward to the day when I didn't have to study or write papers. Maybe after I graduated, I thought, I could get well. I would be able to go to more therapy appointments, spend more time journaling and doing the emotional work I needed to. I knew my major wasn't for me, but still I pushed through classes, binging and purging all the way. When graduation day finally arrived, I felt no pride walking across the stage because I knew I was a failure. The next day, lying on the floor,